Hiya, Niall. Good to talk to you too,
Ricky. Yeah, nice to see you there on our screen. We're still obviously socially distanced at the moment. But just to start by saying, we've had a great reaction to the podcast so far. I'm absolutely delighted.
It's absolutely amazing. Here we are, episode 5, an episode of lots of new things. So we have our first guest today, which is brilliant. And we also have our first female voice on the podcast in Dr. Catherine Farrell, who I spoke to about bogs earlier this week, so I'm looking forward to hearing that chat. It's very exciting.
Yes, absolutely. And just supposed to get the formalities out of the way. So you're Ricky Whelan, I'm Niall Hatch, and the In Your Nature podcast is brought to you by Birdwatch Ireland, Laois and Offaly County Councils, and the Keep Well campaign, an initiative of the Government of Ireland with funding from the Healthy Ireland Fund and the Sláinte Care Fund delivered by Pubble.
The last time I spoke to Catherine in at Lent was actually at Lochbuara Parklands in County Offaly, and it was for the Derek Mooney Dawn Chorus.
Yeah.
When it was, you know, when he pieces it all together from all over the country and all over the world. So we were stationed in Lochbuara. So we had a really great morning there, and we had woodcock and all sorts of stuff. So it'd been a long, long time since me and Catherine had a good natter about bogs. But today's interview was a bit different, I suppose. We're talking more about, I suppose, the pressures that bogs are under, and we're all too familiar with that ourselves. The pressures we see on our birds of our boglands, from our curlew to hen harriers in the upland bogs and all that sort of stuff. So we might go over to the interview and have a listen, and then we'll chat about it in a couple of minutes.
Let's go for it.
As a chap, I grew up in Mount Mellick, County Laois. I mean, you can't get more sort of midlands or bog than that. And I grew up on the bog every summer, and I used to dread when my uncles and my granddad would say the turf is cut, because I knew within weeks of then we would be on the back of a tractor or bet into the back of the car, all the cousins, all the uncles, on the way to Gary Hinch Bog to foot the turf. But they were milled bogs, they were cut bogs. That was my idea of what a bog was, until relatively recently, when I came back from the UK and I got involved at Abileek's Bog, which is a restoration site. It's two totally different things. So, I mean, how do we unite the two? Where do we go from here?
I suppose it's tinged with the childhood memory. What you're finding now is, as people move away from turf cutting, you start to see that the bog can be a place to bring communities together now in a different way. And, you know, what you talked about Abileek's Bog there, and like, that's a really good example where people are coming together on the bog for a different purpose, which is to restore. And whether it's to build bog bridges or to cut back rhododendron, it's that sense of packing up the sandwiches and the flask of tea and heading out there and having the crack, you know, just being immersed in the outdoors.
It's like, though, it's almost like it's two different gangs in a sense. It's like, I've had the strange situation of where I've spent a day at a bog restoration conference, and you've been speaking at them, and your colleagues. And then I'm back in the pub with my mates in Mount Mellick that evening, and I'm at the bar with all the old boys, and we're talking about, you know, foot and turf, and who's got their turf home and who hasn't. And I'm the imposter here. If they find out I'm after being at a conference sort of giving out about these boys, I'll be lynched, you know. And I wouldn't say it's a unique experience, but certainly it's probably a rare one to be sort of have a foot in bog camps.
So I started out in the 1990s working on bog restoration. And so I came from a farm in the Midlands, and we'd never cut turf. I remember one time going to the bog with my uncle and thinking, this is a weird place. You know, those big drains and, you know, big black holes full of black water. And it was sort of very mystical. And then when I started my PhD, I remember getting in my starlet at the time. And I drove
never knock a starlet.
Drove all the way from Streamstown, and I didn't stop, and I got to Achill Island, and I just thought,
wow,
this is phenomenal. And I spent the summers living and working down in Mayo, and I was on my own all the time. I didn't have a mobile phone. There was no fear of working on your own. There was no safety protocols or anything like that. I spent a lot of time immersed in blanket bog landscape. So this is like totally different to the bogs that you would have been in Mount Mellick. Seeing the weather coming in, rolling in from, you know, off the Atlantic, you know, knowing when you needed to walk a kilometre this way to avoid the showers. Never silent. Skylarks. So it was the summertime, so there was that bit more activity in the bog. skylarks yeah. and meadow pipits. And
bugs aren't really known for their bird life. They're not sort of coming down with birds. But the difference in how turf was cut on Acca compared to how it's cut up home or here is incredible. Like, I've got good friends in Ackland. When I visit there, you see, you know, 5, 10, 15 bags of turf that was cut nearly, basically by hand, stacked by the road and brought home in a car trailer. But when I was a boy, even then, the machinery on the Bordnamona bog out the road were colossal. You got, you know, tractors with big flotation tyres, the width of it, width of your Starlet.
So what we're talking about is completely different scales. You know, it's a reflection of, we had the modernisation and the almost industrialisation of agricultural practices, you know, between the 70s and the 80s. And now there's as big a tractors driving around on farm fields as there would have been developed for the Bordnamona lands, you know. And the scale back in the 30s and the 40s, what you had in the Midlands was you had a lot of bogs, a lot of peatland areas with a bit of turf cutting at the edges. And then you had an emergent, nascent state that needed to find a way to, you know, create energy for the family, but also then the new peat-fired stations that were built across the Midlands, yeah. like in Road and near Lullymore. And so that required more efficient ways. So they got very clever, and, you know, it's a testament to the engineering skills, really, of Bordnamona that they transformed it from turf cutting, then they had a thing called a bagger, and then they just developed this milling approach, which meant you could transform 1,000 hectare, so that's a hell of a lot of football fields, into this brown desert essentially with straight lines. And there was, you did not want to be out there standing. Like, Ricky Whelan would not want to be there with his nice white
butterfly
t-shirt
net.
Because, well, first of all, there's no butterflies, but you'd be absolutely covered in dust. Like, this is, it's well engineered, and it's to do that effective, reduced costs, applying the engineer and all that sort of thing. And they did it as best they could. And then while the lads in Bordnamona were doing that, then you had the other lads who were transferring from their way of turf cutting to things like the hopper, and getting a lot more industrialised in terms of the domestic sod turf production. Mm-hmm. So these industrial scale things, they really need restorative measures. And by that I mean that when they're finished, if you're turf cutting and you're leaving a big cliff edge at the edge of the bog, you need to start thinking about, you know, a few years before you finish, how you're going to profile that edge. Because first of all, that's a health and safety hazard. Imagine a child running across the edge of that into a big
sure.
black hole. And then it's in terms of trying to sort of back up the water in the cutover and the cutaway at the edge of the bog, so that that can start to regenerate, and that regenerates very well with peatland species. So that's your turf banks. And now I suppose the whole landscape has changed in the last couple of years. I just, every time I look at the news, there's some new grant or award for peatland restoration. And in fairness, a lot of it seems now to be going to Bordnamona to assist in what they're calling, you know, the rehabilitation of the cutaways. Now, the reason they call it rehabilitation is because it's not technically restoration. So, you know,
well, it's not, because a restoration would indicate that it's going back to its pristine state. No. But that can never be achieved.
Not in our lifetimes. And this was a hard lesson I learned when I started in the 90s. So I was asked to develop a restoration plan for the cutaway Blanca bog down there. And I quickly realised I couldn't use restoration and cutaway together. That what I was essentially able to do was to re-wet what was left behind, and that it was bringing it back in time. You were literally going back in time thousands of years and bringing the bog back to how it started off, which meant you were putting it back on its path. But you couldn't call that restoration, because it infers all these other things when you're talking about habitats of conservation status. And
I feel like we've really not let up on bogs. So even, like, just say we did the real divil when we industrialised things after the war. And, you know, the first harm, I suppose, we committed was when you take the top layer of vegetation off the bog, it basically makes it unhospitable for bog fauna, for your frogs, for your for your butterflies, for your other invertebrates and newts and lizards and all that sort of stuff. You know, then we milled it for peat and we created these big brown deserts. And then, I suppose, Bordemona or whoever pulled the gate behind them, and they began to, when the pumps went off, they would get wetter, or the drains were blocked in some cases. They got wetter and the vegetation started to redevelop, and you get lots of headers and various things on the drier parts, and maybe sphagnums and those wetter plants in the wetter areas. But then that wasn't good enough for us. We had to start planting forestry on our peatlands because it was seen as marginal land, I suppose, cheap land. And then when that wasn't good enough, we start sticking wind turbines all over the place, which to me, as an environmentalist, as a conservationist, on paper, wind turbines are yes. But in practice, in many sites, it's a big no-no. So we often say wind in the right place. And we see these empty spaces, or what we derive as empty spaces, as these bleak landscapes. And we just want to fill them with something. And it's weird. I don't know where it comes from.
It's definitely in the Irish psyche to use these lands. And we haven't understood them well, but we now understand them better. To me, that means let's not keep making the same mistakes. I mean, the definition of madness is you keep doing the same thing again and again. Nah. These were lands to be used. So Todd Andrews, who was the father of Bordemona, back in the 1930s said, you know, we're going to get rid of all these bogs and we're going to transform them into land that we can use to grow crops and make them proper.
Yeah.
So it was productive. This complete mismatch between what the bog is actually doing. So now we know, first of all, the bog is, I mean, apart from being an absolutely spectacular landscape and in and of itself has value as a habitat, we know that it is actually, when it's working properly, it's sequestering, which means it's drawing down carbon from the atmosphere. The stuff that's already there in the form of peat that stays wet is a carbon stock. So we're keeping that in the ground. So the other thing that it's doing when it's working properly, when it's a good, wet, soggy bog, is when it rains, it traps water, it holds water, and then there's a slow release of water. So it actually reduces the risk of flooding. So when you drain it, you lose the flood mitigation. Suddenly, all the sediment is going out in the water, so you're actually impacting on water quality. And then by the air getting into the peat layer, it actually can start to break down the peat, so you're releasing the carbon. So all of these things are, you know, I was trying to convey this to a group of students recently, and, you know, like, we're so used to saying, oh, well, the bogs are a threatened landscape and, you know, we're losing them. But they're actually threatening as well, because by leaving them in the state they're in, they're actually having a negative impact on our environment and ultimately our health and well-being, because it's all down to us. It's all, everything is driven through the lens of how we view this land.
You mean it's threatening because if we sort of pull the gate after us, milling the peat, but then it's been, what's left of the peat is being baked by the sun and the carbon has been released and it's doing us harm. Is that what you mean?
Drained peatlands are emitting carbon. Okay, so that's contributing to climate change. Okay, so if we just walk away and just leave these landscapes after we've used them and say, oh, good luck, I'm heading home, and, you know, the drainage is left intact. Now, sure enough, in some places, the drains will start to infill themselves, but they actually need a lot more time and thought and effort to get them back up and running the way they can be. Or water quality, flood mitigation, carbon sinks, and to keep the carbon that's left there in the ground so it doesn't actually make the climate change worse. And then, of course, the biodiversity. People often separate biodiversity and climate change.
Well, I was just about to fall into that trap.
There you go. They always do that. And
well, let me tell you, right? So when I was a kid, I would have went to the bog, we would have done nature walks with school, all that stuff. We would have visited Michael Jacob in Lullymore in the IPCC centre there, and like blown away by Michael and all the specimens.
He's a legend.
Legend.
Yeah.
And all the stuff he showed us. And but he was like back then, I mean, obviously for the interest of primary school children, he was focused in on the wildlife side of thing and the biodiversity side of thing. And my first memories of the bog foot and turf getting bored, and you'd lift a foot and you'd lift, what the footing is basically the stacked sods, for anyone that's know what I mean, and you throw it into the trailer. But often when you lifted the whole thing, a frog or a newt or a lizard, and lots of people don't even realise we have lizards in Ireland, common lizards, viviparous lizards.
Yep.
Amazing. First time I ever seen them was stacking the turf on the bog, and these amazing sort of caterpillars, or hairy mollies as we call them, which are the species of various moths. And I always thought the problems with bogs was it was a biodiversity problem. And now we've sort of, like you say, we've parceled it all up. We've made it two different things, biodiversity and climate change. But like you say, it's one problem, really.
Well, biodiversity is the species. It's the genetic variation within the species. And then it's also the diversity of habitats. You know, so the bog itself is biodiversity. So I think this is the mismatch. You know, people sort of think, oh, the biodiversity loss, that's over there. But the bog, and not just the bogs, the woodlands, all the different habitats, the salt marsh, all these things, when they are working well as habitats, as, you know, manifestations of biodiversity, they are working to regulate our climate. And we've all evolved together. So this is the point. We're in it. And we're part of the ecosystem, or the greater network of habitats. We've evolved with these different habitats. And so we're all sort of working together, but we're relying on these life support systems, essentially, for us. That's the mismatch, that climate regulation is a product of these diverse systems. So, you know, I think it's trying to square the circle. And I think in ways, you know, I think about this a lot, because I'm always asked, you know, questions like, oh, what's the biodiversity and, you know, climate, and they're on separate sides of, you know, the room sort of thing. But I think we'll get there. I think that when biodiversity was introduced, it sort of seemed to be more about species, or that's what people latched on to. Whereas, you know, wildlife, I think, was more of an encompassing wildlife and nature. They're better words to describe the bigger world and land that we live in, and that we're part of nature. You know, language is important, and language creates pictures in our heads. And
talk about language, and talk about the wrong words to use. Sequestration. I can't even say that. Like, never mind the lads, you know, Finty and Kieran and Tommy and the boys I'll have a pint with about and talk about this. They will not get their head around that, because, like, it's even hard to say. Like, come on.
It sounds like a medical procedure, in fairness.
It
sounds
really
like something
does.
You're not getting a sequestration, are you? Jeez, lads.
No. And, like, come on. And listen, before we go too sort of off in a tangent, I want to just mention a couple of bogs in the Midlands that, to give people a taste of the good, the bad and the ugly, I suppose. So, like, if you drive to Lochbura from Tullamore, say, if you're coming down the motorway into Tullamore, go to Lochbura to see what a rehabilitation site can be. And you come across that bog road from the Blue Ball there, and you'll see both sides of the road, these cutaway, the milled cutaway bogs. So that's for anyone that wants to see what we mean by those brown deserts. They'll see those both sides of the road. Then you get to Bura, which has now created this mosaic of wetlands and drier habitats and pioneer woodlands with beech and alder and all sorts of stuff moving in. And that's really nice, but not typical at all of what you see. And then to see some, like, celebrated restored sites, I suppose. Abileek's Bog in South Leash is a really, really good example. And Clara Bog as well is another one that's really highly thought of amongst sort of, you know, the ecologists and all that. So I think I just wanted to mention those sites, really, for people if we ever get out of these lockdowns, if people want to jump in their car and see what it is these bogs are about.
Lochbura is just beautiful. Look, I used to be based there, and I used to walk out there at least twice a day. I used to bring the dog to work. It was just like this wonderful place. But Lochbura is not a bog. You hit the nail on the head. When you walk to it, you see a lake. You actually see a stand of conifer trees, pine trees.
Uh-huh.
You see a bit of scrub, so that's like a bit of willow. And you see wetland, like soggy land with a bit of cattails and bulrushes, we call them. So that's not a bog, but it's a really nice place to go. It's a good example of what the industrial scale peatlands might be turned into. If you go more towards Abileek's, And then there's another one that I really like. It's Ballydanganbog. It's just near Athlone. And just if you walk out onto the bog, you'll see the absolute difference, because you won't be going anywhere without your wellies. It's not a bog unless you need to wear wellies. That's the key thing. So anything that's dry underfoot that you can wear a nice pair of runners on, you're not on a bog. But
that's my lasting image of Michael as well, back when we were in, Michael Jacob, when we were in primary school, is him on what he described as a quaking bog. And he was stood in his wellies on this nice part of really wet Lullymore, and he was jumping up and down. And the whole bog was wobbling like a jelly, and that's what you mean by, like, that's a proper bog. That's what a bog's supposed to do.
That is exactly. And you, when you stand there for too long, you're up to your ankles, and then you'll always, like, as I was saying, I've been out, you know, many days on my own, but it's only when someone's with you on the bog that you'll actually fall in a bog hole or a drain. So, like, they're not the dry Loughborough type, but Loughborough is really accessible. It's a nice parklands. That's what it is. I think that probably the area around Coolnamona, if we're going to start talking about how landscapes are going to be transformed in the Midlands, so the Coolnamona bogs are just south of Port Leash, between Port Leash and Abbey Leaks. Those are examples of bogs that are now black deserts. And those bogs, if you went out today and blocked the drains, literally just went in with a digger or a dozer and blocked the drains every 20 yards, you get the water back in the bog, and that's where you'd start getting the bog mosses growing again. So we should be taking out the bogs that still have a bit of deep peat in them and restoring them to keep the carbon in the ground, to improve water quality. And I suppose that was one of the things I wanted to come back, that we're often talking about bogs and biodiversity and climate change, but it's the water. Water is the absolute key. And to me, like, the bog is, it's three things. It's water, it's the plants and animals on it, so that's the wildlife, and then it's the soil. So you can't have any of those things out of balance. They all have to be in balance together.
Water, like, is a dirty word in this country now. Like, I even seen just in today or yesterday's paper, I mean, the IFA are looking for sort of reassurances from Bord na Mona about the 80 bogs they're about to restore or rehabilitate, that neighbouring farmland is not going to flood. And because of climate change, because of the divilment we've done to our bogs and everything else around the world, we've caused this sort of change in our weather patterns, and now we're getting all this rain. And I mean, the Shannon is in flood now in the spring, and it's just bananas. And people rightly so are afraid of water. And my own house flooded a couple of years ago at Christmas, and God, it was just awful. But
it's back to language. So I learned very quickly when I was doing my work down in Mayo, and after I did my research, I was employed to actually, you know, restore 6,500 hectares, or rehabilitate, re-wet that area. And a lot of people nearby were like, well, you're going to flood my land. And so what we did was we took it nice and slow and steady, and not one house has been flooded. And I would say, and I know this from local people and especially the local fishermen, to say that the natural flooding regime in the river was restored, because you actually reduced that big rush of water. When the rain fell on the bog actually held the water. And there was a slow release effect. I absolutely, you know, I understand genuine concerns about this word. I would never use that word, flooding. And please don't ever use it again, Ricky, when you're talking about re-wetting bogs. And I say that, I recommend that highly. The rehabilitation of the Bord na Mona bogs, when it's done properly, when I mean properly, I mean bringing lads out on site and showing them exactly what's going to do, talking them through their concerns about their lands, it's going to reduce flooding for everyone. And we need that. We need it now more than ever, because you just said, you know, there's going to be more increased intense rainfall periods. We need the bogs to work with us. And water is, it's inevitable with the climate change, with the changes in the weather patterns, all that sort of things. So to me, water is, we need to talk more about water.
There's a lot to think about there, Ricky, isn't there? I have to say, Catherine does a very good job of explaining just why bogs are so important. And I think how crucially they've been undervalued here in Ireland. I think one of the biggest tragedies of all in environmental circles in Ireland is how bogs have been for so long seen as wasteland, you know, something useless, when in fact they are absolutely vital, not just to wildlife, but our own well-being as human beings as well. They're really, really vital. And it's such a shame we've lost so much, but there is still time to turn the tide and preserve what we have. I think that's very important to remember.
No, that's definitely the take-home message. I think the take-home message is that peatlands are still under a lot of pressure. We're still just taking too much from them. But there is life in the old bog yet. And if we can get them wet and keep them wet, it's good for carbon and climate change, and it's good for biodiversity. And Catherine's sort of trying to beat that message home, really, that the two things are not separable and they shouldn't be separated, really. So I think that's a really important message. But I suppose from our point of view, we often refer to birds as environmental indicators of the health of different habitats and the environment as a whole. And I suppose the various declines we see in bogland birds, or, you know, heathland species as well, is sort of very clear to us. So, like, I mean, knock it back to you there and we could talk about hen harriers maybe.
Yes, an absolutely gorgeous bird, one that's been quite controversial in Ireland, and our boglands are absolutely essential for that species. So for those who don't know the hen harrier, it's quite a large bird of prey, a very slow flying, slow moving one that tends to just float across over bogland, particularly in the breeding season. They'll go over agricultural fields and other habitats as well, but the bogs are central to their lives. They like to hunt over heather. They very much have made a living for themselves hunting mainly small birds, but also some mammals as well. But they got things like meadow pipits and other species that tend to live around bogs. So, you know, the Irish ecosystem is ideal for them, or at least it would have been, you know, centuries ago. You know, hen harriers must have been a very common bird. They've been really pushed to the edge for various reasons. Obviously, there's been a lot of destruction of the bogs over the years in various different ways, but also disturbance. So I know in the interview there, yourself and Catherine discussed wind farms, and they've been a problem for hen harriers because the disturbance when they're, you know, put in otherwise pristine bogland, the construction phase, it causes interruption, disruption for these very sensitive birds of prey. Like most birds of prey, they're very highly strung. But not just that, of course, when the turbines are then whirring, the hen harrier, particularly the way they hunt, they have almost like an owl-like facial disc. They use their hearing to help them hunt. So they're drifting slowly over the surface of the ground, and they have their heads down looking and listening for prey. So they sometimes will fly into turbine blades without even realizing they were there. So they have a disproportionate impact on them. And it's, you know, it's a species, I said, it was controversial because there were concerns by people over the years that land would be designated or has been designated for the protection of hen harriers. This has caused problems for development and for forestry and so on in some areas. And I think that's something that the state needs to do more to show landowners and stakeholders that they value the presence of these birds by making sure that, you know, hen harrier farming, I suppose, in a way is a viable way forward. We need to do more to put money in the pockets of the people who are safeguarding these magnificent species.
100%. And I think that anyone that's ever seen harriers and harriers sky dancing when the male and the female do that whole mating ritual, and it's just, it's breathtaking. And the most hardened farmer, hill farmer in the world couldn't but stop to have a look and appreciate what it is. And there's no, like we say, there's no farmer gets up in the morning, wrings his hand and goes, I'm going up the mountain now to make life tough for the hen harriers. But they have to make a living too, and we have to stop. People like us have to stop sort of picking rows with people like them, because actually we have a lot in common, and it's the ground we're trying to protect, really. And hopefully we can figure out a mechanism of doing that, because currently the way we do things isn't really working for anyone.
Yes, a real bugbear of mine is the way that the media in particular likes to always pitch conservationists and farmers against each other as though we're diametrically opposed views and lifestyles, when the opposite is the case. We need each other, for the purposes of sustainable agriculture and going forward and making sure that this is a livelihood that people can continue to depend on into the future for future generations. We need to find ways to prioritise our environment, but we also need to recognise when it comes to farmland birds and bogland birds as well, if it wasn't for those custodians and stewards of the landscape, they'd already be gone. That's the important part. So I think that that's something we always need to bear in mind. We, of course, in Birdwatcher, and we work with a great many farmers and other landowners in terms of their preservation of their lands. I think that sometimes I think that the larger representing organisations for those groups perhaps don't fully appreciate or understand just how important nature is to many of their own members. And I think they're not necessarily not hearing the full picture, perhaps.
Bogs are bleak places, or they can come across as very bleak and severe at first without really getting down or spending time to sort of find what's there. Like, here's some news for people. We have lizards in Ireland, the viviparous lizard, the common lizard. They are on bogs. They're in sand dunes. Go look for one of those, you'll be amazed. Like, they're in our bogs. We have newts on bogs. We've hairy mollies on bogs. We have a plethora of insects and butterflies on our bogs. All the bird, like, it's not, I suppose, is it fair to say a bog isn't the first habitat you'd race to find a rich diversity of birds?
Yes, that's certainly true. I mean, if you go to a bog, you might be a while before you actually see a bird. And in terms of the species diversity, it is lower than, let's say, a native woodland would be, or even a coastal estuary. You'll see more birds and wildlife there. But the thing is that in many ways, the wildlife of bogland, it's more hidden. They're so well adapted to the life there that they're much harder to see. They're better camouflaged. They don't need to come out in the open. I mean, the bog is a very stark environment. It's very harsh, it's very unforgiving. A lot of these plants and animals don't really want to expose themselves to the elements. But what's really important about them is that the flora and fauna you find there tends to be really unique. So the biodiversity value of those bogs, it's absolutely crucial. I remember David Bellamy, obviously the celebrated naturalist, he said that boglands were one of his favourite habitats, and he said that this is a place where Ireland should be punching above its weight, because we have, you know, some of the best bogland habitat in Europe. We've lost a great deal of it, but the fact is we should think of it as our Amazon rainforest. It is that important for biodiversity. And I think at the moment, when everyone is talking about climate change and the need to absorb as much carbon dioxide as we can, one of the things that you yourself and Catherine touched on in your discussion there earlier is the actual power that bogs have to help Ireland meet its climate and carbon emissions targets. I was researching something a few weeks ago, and it actually blew me away. Bogland, peat bog, only covers 3% of the Earth's land surface, but it contains more carbon, twice as much carbon as all the world's forests combined. This isn't wasteland. Even if people don't care about wildlife whatsoever, it is vital for combating climate change and making sure that Ireland lives up to its targets, so that we're not fined, by missing all of the targets that have been set for us. So
that's just a humongous stat, and just that alone should be evidence enough, reason enough for us all to sort of get, you know, the shoulder to the wheel and make sure our boglands are conserved and preserved, and end of story, you know. It's crazy, but I suppose I see bogs in two different sets. There's upland bogs and there's the lowland bogs. In the lowlands, I would be always thinking stuff like stonechats. I'd be thinking cuckoos. I'd be thinking meadow pipits, skylarks. And in the uplands, I'm thinking merlin. I'm thinking hen harriers, red grouse. Stuff like that. So they're both bogs, but they're kind of like, it's still two different sports when you kind of go birdwatching at either of those habitats.
Oh, absolutely, Ricky. They're very different, and I think that sometimes lumping them all together does kind of, I suppose, it hides the diversity that is there. Certainly, you know, I love going bird and nature watching in bogs. You have to be prepared. You know, as you said, a proper living bog is something very squishy. It is like almost like jelly the way it wobbles. You have to be careful. You have to have your wits about you. I live close to the Wicklow Mountains, so I know the upland bog habitat there very well. The amount of times that I've got lost up there, you know, trying to go around and you fall down a sinkhole or something, you have to be really careful. But and wildlife is, it can seem few or far between, but then all of a sudden you come across some red grouse that flush up, or you see some golden plover up on the top of a rise of a hill. It's absolutely amazing. And then you have the botany aspect of it as well. There are so many plants that will only live in bogland, and that's different, you know, whether you're on a blanket bog or on an upland bog, but they're really, really unique. And then obviously there's particular types of moths whose caterpillars will only feed on those specific plants. It's absolutely mind-blowing. One of my favourite, though, I remember the first time I saw a sundew plant. in a bog, and that blew me away because that's obviously a carnivorous plant. It eats insects. We think of these as being, you know, something that you'd see in a horror movie or something that you'd only see in exotic, you know, far-flung jungles on a nature documentary. We have these in Ireland. It's absolutely remarkable. And I think if people knew more about what's in bogs, they would appreciate them more, because a lot of people, their only experience of bogs is driving past that brown desert, you know, where the whole surface layer has been removed. There's no wildlife, not much by way of wildlife value for that. And it does seem like wasteland. But if you see this living, breathing, spongy, wet bog, it's quite a different beast.
It's funny, you brought up caterpillars there as well. I have to get this in. Just reading and listening to various things the last few days and weeks. The hairy mollies, which hopefully most people have at least seen one in their lives. They're like these giant caterpillars, hairy caterpillars that sort of like cross the sort of street at speed sometimes. Or you see, like, they're quite fast when they get going. But that word comes from the Irish for eyebrow, which is molly. M-A-L-A-I fada, which is eyebrow, which I think is just cool. I just wanted to get that out there. But they're everywhere. You see them all over the bogs in the right season. And at home here, I'm at the foot of the Slieve Blooms, and if I just go up the mountain there, we are in prime hen harrier and red grouse country. So it's like, it's so good up there. So if people want to try connect with those species, the Slieve Blooms in Laois and Offaly is the place to do it. And if they want to connect with lots of invertebrates, you will not get a better bog than Abileague's Bog in South County Laois. I'm telling you, it's in the middle of June or July, it's coming down with the best butterflies and rare moths and bees you're going to get. So get down there when it's safe to do so. That's what I'm saying. And I have a big grin on my face thinking about it. It's like, it's been so long since I've been in the middle of a bog, but and I was waxing lyrical with Catherine about sort of as a boy being on the bog, cutting turf and doing all that sort of stuff. And I sort of feel like I'm some sort of like asshole for doing that, and I feel guilty. But look, it's one of those things, and it's been our culture, and it's slowly changing, but it's for the best now. And listen, I think I want to talk about what I think is probably the boggiest bird of all time. And we're going into Bird of the Week here, which people are really enjoying, I think. And I think people really love this species. Anyone that knows of it, it's the snipe.
Oh, I certainly love the snipe. They're great birds. You know, a wader, but behaves very differently to any other wader in Ireland. I think they're remarkable. And the bogs are so important for them, absolutely. I usually get to see them, particularly in the winter, when they go to the marshes and some more coastal areas, so places like Bull Island, Booterstown Marsh, and on the east coast of Ireland. They're great for them. But they, of course, are bogland breeders, and they really love that wet, boggy habitat. It's really crucial for them.
Would you describe them for us?
Yes, so they're sort of a relatively small wading bird. All waders sort of follow the same sort of basic blueprint. They tend to have fairly long bills, and the snipe has a very, very long beak. They tend to have quite long legs, and they tend to be quite cryptically plumaged, so they're very well camouflaged. Now, the snipe certainly ticks all of those boxes, so the beak is almost absurdly long. The legs are long, but you don't often see them that much because they tend to creep around the edges of bogs and of marshes. The plumage, it's wonderful sort of striping, different types of tones of brown, some yellow buff tones in there, and some black. So they blend in really well when they're against a backdrop of bogland plants, and also reed beds and habitats like that. And it's a bird that likes to not really come into the open that much. They tend to hide. They probe down into the bogs or into the mud with their long beaks trying to find food.
Cool thing about their bills is that the tip is flexible, and it's full of nerves, which helps them find earthworms and all sorts of invertebrates, and helps them catch them that way, which is really cool. And for the size of their skull, like I would probably guesstimate that what their bill is about 2.5 times the width of their skull.
Oh, it must
maybe
be, yes. It's really, really long. And so they're really interesting to see. They also have a very unusual looking head too, because it's very stripy, but they have these very large eyes that are very wide set on the side of their head. They kind of bulge out, similar to a woodcock. They're closer related to woodcocks. They're in the same group of waders. And that gives them very good all-round vision, which is what you need. If you're crouched down in a bog and you're looking for predators coming, you need to be able to see all the way around you. So it's like they almost have 360 degree vision all the way around them, which I think is you know, that's why people can't sneak up on them. And they're a bird that it'll usually see you before you see it. So what'll happen is you're walking through the bog, or it could be in winter, particularly at an estuary perhaps in the coast, and all of a sudden you'll get this bird making sort of a sneezing call. It'll flush up from, you know, a few meters in front of you.
Let's play the call.
That's the one. That's the one.
Yeah, sneeze. Actually, I was trying to think of a way of describing that. Sneeze is perfect. Well done.
And what they do is they'll take off of you, but unlike a lot of other waders, just go in a direct line. What the snipe does, it zigzags. It goes up and starts zipping back and forth. And that's an adaptation to make it harder for predators like merlins, this predatory falcon, to catch them because they're zigzagging. But it also meant that they were very highly regarded as a quarry species for hunters, and still are. So they're hunted. People shoot them. And the fact was they had the reputation of being the hardest game bird to shoot because of the zigzagging. You couldn't really predict what they'd do. So a marksman who was good enough to be able to shoot a snipe was known as a sniper. And that's where that expression comes from. So everybody knows that, at least by reputation. That's where the word sniper originated.
That's amazing. And like, that's a lot of adaptation. So if you think about it, so they've got that really cryptic plumage, they've got the zigzag flight, they've got the eyes positioned in the right place. Like, they're kind of, everything thinks they're tasty, and they've had to evolve a lot of adaptations to avoid the trouble. They're really amazing, and they've also got a smaller cousin, equally as tasty, equally as interesting, and that's the jacksnipe.
Oh yes, the jacksnipe. It's always a treat to see one of those. I think they're probably not a terribly rare bird in Ireland, but they're definitely under-recorded because they're incredibly secretive, even more so than the common snipe that we're used to. The jacksnipe is just a non-breeding visitor to us here in Ireland. The population that comes to us here for the winter, they seem to actually mainly come from the Baltic region, so around Latvia, Lithuania, Kaliningrad, other parts of Russia. That's where they come from. They're really tiny. Jack means small in Old English. If you think of a jackdaw, jackdaw meant small crow. Jack snipe, a small snipe. They really are very secretive. And unlike the common snipe, which will flush at a distance, the jack snipe, whenever I do see them, they tend to put the heart sideways in me because they don't flush until you're about to stand on them. So you don't know that they're there. And all of a sudden, they just go up the big sort of clatter of wings and they fly up. They go in a big arch. They loop up in the air. Then they land on the ground, probably scuttle away, and they're virtually impossible to flush the second time. I've never actually seen them on their breeding grounds, but they actually have an amazing breeding display. They sound like galloping horses. Really, really odd noise that they make. So in many of the languages in the countries where they breed, there's an association like little horse of the bog, that kind of thing. So it's a bogland breeder in other countries, but here in Ireland they'll go to bogs, they'll also go to coastal wetlands, but very hard to see because they're so secretive.
Brilliant. And that's a good one. That little sort of little horse of the bog is brings us back then to its bigger cousin, the original one we're talking about, the common snipe, which is often referred to as milk goat and goat of the bog and goat of the night and all these things. And that's because its drumming call, its mating, the call it makes to attract females, which isn't an auditory note from its body or its vocal cords. It's made with its tail. Now, you can explain that in a second. But it's called drumming, but it sounds like the bleating of a goat. Which is strange. And I a number of years ago, I got a voice message or a voice recording message from an American friend of mine who was camping in Iceland, and he was terrified. It was like a Blair Witch moment. He's like, I'm in my tent, there is this bird sound, and it sounds extraterrestrial, and I'm not sure if it's a bird or not. And I'm like, play it for me. And it was a snipe drumming. It does sound extraterrestrial. Let's listen to that now.
What a sound that is. It's remarkable, and it is very spooky.
It's crazy.
When you're out on a bog, and normally you'd hear it just around dusk, so it's getting dark. You'll hear them after the sun has set as well, to a degree, and it's really weird. And when you hear it in isolation like that in a recording, it sounds static, but when you're hearing it from the bird itself, it's moving very rapidly past you, around you. So this weird sound is coming from the air. It's kind of going all the way around you. It sounds like it's coming closer than getting further away. It sounds almost ghostly. And especially if you're in an area with a good population of snipes, if you have multiple of them doing it all around you simultaneously, it really is quite spooky. Until you realise what it is and realise, it's actually, there's no harm there whatsoever. It's just a really interesting sound. But it is amazing. This is essentially the song of the snipe. It's the male that does it. But as you said, he's not doing it with his voice. He's doing it with his tail. And what they do is they have these specially stiffened little tail feathers that's on the outer part of their tail that they can just flare out. So they stick them out in the wind. When they dive at a particular angle at a particular speed, those two feathers start to vibrate As they're moving, they vibrate in the air and they make this noise. And it's amazing that such a small bird can actually produce such volume with two small little feathers in its tail. And that's how that sound is made. It's amazing to think of that. But not all songs, I suppose, because it ticks all the boxes of being an actual song. It's for attracting mates, proclaiming territory, all of that. But they're not all done by voice. Another example of that would be the woodpecker. So the great spotted woodpecker, essentially its song is its different type of drumming, where it's sort of the rat-a-tat-tat on a tree. The drumming of the snipe is with its tail. And drumming, I've always thought, is a funny description of it, because it doesn't sound like a drum in any way. It does sound more like a bleating goat. But that's the expression, drumming. For some reason, that's what it's been called.
Yeah, but like as I said, all those colloquial names are all refer back to goat and stuff, which makes more sense. The old names are often the better ones. That's cool. Listen, that's species of the week, and delighted. Yeah, our first guest, our first sort of focused habitat discussion, really nice. And next week, good news again. We have we're talking wildflowers with Dr. Fiona McGowan, which is deadly, and it's a really good time of year because I notice now on our own lane, the lesser celandine and various spring flowers are starting to emerge as well. So it's a really good time for that episode to be coming out in very early April. So look forward to having a chat with Fiona.
Just to say as well to everybody who's listening to us, make sure to get out and enjoy bird migration. That's kicking off. We have the dawn chorus really in full voice now at the moment, getting better and better. So do enjoy that. And just to say, if you enjoy this podcast and you like to hear us prattling on about birds and you're interested in the work that Birdwatch Ireland does, please do spread the word to your friends and family, but also do join Birdwatch Ireland as members. We really need your help. It's not just about the money we raise from that, which all goes to support our conservation work. The more members we have, the more clout we have when it comes to looking for action to help support landowners who are trying to do the best for wildlife, to help dictate policy here in Ireland. It's really important. You also get a lovely magazine when you join us, Wings magazine. We're really pleased about that too. You get a lovely welcome pack. Full details at birdwatchireland.ie, and if you do that for us, it would help us so much. We'd be very grateful.
This podcast is brought to you by Birdwatch Ireland, Laois an Offaly County Councils and the Keep Well Campaign, an initiative of the Government of Ireland with funding from the Healthy Ireland Fund and the Sláintecare Fund delivered by Pubble. The In Your Nature podcast is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly.